Maybe you can shut the door, please. Okay, and then we'll start. Om Vijnana Timurandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Taksurun Mlitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Shayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati sapadantikam vancha kalpa tarubhyasya kripa sindhu bayebhacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo nama Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasade Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. Okay. As Kastubha Prabhu said or indicated, actually, this class is almost like a dream for me. Almost like I worked my whole life for it. Because initially, I started in India most of my devotional career. And what I would do is I would teach the sacred texts of India. That's what I would do. Kind of to the choir. You know, you teach the shastra. And that was really my love. And then at a particular time, by the quirk of fate, like if I was a little piece of tumbleweed or cotton, then Krishna went like this. And then I kind of wound up a little bit more in America. And then I was trying to figure out, okay, who's going to hear me? No one knows who I am. You know, I just can't. Dhanadhara Swami giving a class, you know. And so then I had to figure out, because I'm an American, one thing we are good at is marketing. So I figured this class, The Psychology of Karma, and just to make sure some people were there, you could sign up and get a astrological reading or something. And then Yoga Maya every year, when I come back, I have to get a new seminar because you just can't go around teaching the same thing if you stay in the same place. And if I traveled around the world, I can have one class. But I had to come up with environment on consciousness, drama as yoga, and, you know, one after another, just to kind of attract people to hear this message. And now it's kind of come full circle. Kind of, I'm able to do what I really love is to teach the sacred texts, you know, systematically. And, you know, to the kind of same people we were trying to share this with, you know, now they really want to go further. And there's nothing, if like studying the sacred texts, if you really want to transform your heart. Even I have a phone sangha, you know, twice a week, and people have been on it for 10 years, and I see they change, because this is the process. They change. But before I get into that, a little bit about the format. What I'm trying to say is this is going to be more or less a classical style of teaching. We're bringing back the classical style. Of course, the entertainment will be there, because it's bhakti, and bhakti is not about renunciation, it's about dedication, and I am who I am. And that part will be there, but it'll be a classical style. And the classical style is, I'm going to teach the Shastra systematically, a particular text. I'm going to prepare it and try to present it as digestible and clear as possible. And you're welcome to come. And you want to learn? Then learn. You know, I'm going to teach. I'm going to try to make it as interesting as possible. And it's up to you. I'm not going to give any tests. You know, it's based on your internal desire. Do you want to change your heart and advance on the path of bhakti, or perhaps even learn a particular text and learn more about a tradition, then you're welcome to come. And but at the same time, I do have 9 classes to teach the text. I know the text very, very well. But still, I don't feel I have to teach every single detail. You know, but and I'll concentrate on certain parts more than the others. One thing about the course that I think will be really interesting, I wrote a commentary on the Nectar of Devotion, and you get them in the the cafe, the Bhakti Center store, and it basically is your notes view. It's pretty much acclaimed as the text in the Hare Krishna movement to study this particular book. Any Bhakti Shastri course they have in ISKCON, they use this book. So really, get one of the books. You can buy it. It'll be great for the course. It helps you understand. At the same time, you won't have to worry so much about. You can take notes, and I think it's great to take notes, but you won't have to worry so much. It covers it pretty completely. And I don't want to just rush and cover a certain amount. I really want you to understand the core principles of this text. And I'll work very hard to do it. And I hope as students, you'll work very hard to understand it. And I will be open to questions, but there's so many deep subjects, I may also sometimes have to curtail that also and just be open to discuss it further. I also am going to start a Facebook group that people who are registered can access, and we'll post a video of the class, and I may give any relevant materials if you want to look at them, and also answer any questions there if you want. And therefore, there's certain people here that are coming from far away, especially. They may not make a class, and some of you may not be able to make a class one day, but try to come to the classes. It's really something special about seeing me live. give me your feedback, even about if the room's set up in the proper way, if you're comfortable, et cetera. Just a show of hands. Is anybody going to stop in the Bhakti Cafe afterwards? Okay, a few people will. Okay. Would anybody like a free meal? Because Vera Budra cooked too much for his thing, but I think it's good for people just to go to the Bhakti Cafe after, and I'll be down there. I'll be down there. And I generally start with a question because it's, and this is just also learning about teaching is. When I speak, you're passive, but I like to make you active. And so I'll ask you a question. If there was nothing in your life and consciousness that needed to be changed, would you come to this class? Sarah? You understand the question? Would you, anybody like to? Yeah, we'd just like to come see you. Or, there's so many reasons you could give, but the point I'm making is generally people get knowledge because they want to be happy and they need knowledge to change. And a proper culture, this is what they do. I like it also because what actually we should all be living, we all live in the same village, but it's a little hard to get here. But it should be almost like just a few blocks. you know, maybe even in the country. You know, and the typical culture of a sustainable community, this would be something people do every day because it's so essential in human life to advance. And to advance means to change. So let me ask you something. What in you do you really want to change? I mean, in terms of this, what do you hope to change? Like if you end the course, welcome. Okay. Have a seat, please, any place. Sitting down. I understand people come from different places. Don't worry. Good. Okay, good. What is it you want to change?
Selfishness.
What?
Selfishness.
What?
Selfish.
You want to be less selfish. Yeah. Yes. Anybody else?
Yeah.
What? What? You want to learn more. But why do you want to learn more?
Because this is it.
This is it. This is what you want to. Bryn? You want to change your heart. Okay, I asked this question in the other class. If you achieve perfection, what would it be like inside? And how would it be different from what you are now? Anyway, what this tradition is about changing the heart and getting knowledge to change the heart. And we were discussing this more. I gave a 15-minute class to Raghunath's class. And the perfection in Krishna consciousness, but I think it's just the perfection of life. Or what would it be like in perfection? And according to our tradition, what it would be like is you'd be overwhelmed with love. And the highest love is love for God. And that's called rasa. Just be completely overwhelmed. Like, you ever had some sadness called, you ever had tragedy? You're just completely overwhelmed with sadness. Humor, you ever get, what is it? What do they call when you can't laugh to the greatest degree? What?
Hysterical.
Yeah, hysterical. You ever get hysterical? I once got hysterical. I don't know why it was, but I was with Kastubha's guru, and we were reading one of the sacred texts, actually one of the dramas. We were reading one of the dramas, and it was a Krishna pastime. And it was kind of, I don't know why, I had to leave the room. And what happened was, it was a part where Krishna was going to meet Radharani. And Radharani would go to see the sun god to worship for the health and prosperity of her husband. And her mother-in-law would take us. This is a little esoteric, but they would go. So Krishna wanted to meet Radha. So what Krishna did is he dressed up as the priest. And then Radharani's mother-in-law came along with Radharani and started to beg the priest to do this sacrifice with Radha, you know, and to go into the chamber and the altar. And then Krishna, playing a monk, said something like, Annie, you won't laugh, son. He said, you know, I'm such a strict brahmachari. I never do anything like this, you know. Anyway, monk, but forget it. It may not be so funny, but I was absolutely hysterical. And, you know, or even, I say chivalry. You know, you can see some, like, great chivalrous thing, you know, dun-ta-dun-ta-dun-ta-dun-ta-dun-ta-dun, the people charge. So perfection in Krishna consciousness is to be overwhelmed with love. And that's what, when we talk about the Bhagavatam, we talk about the Krishna stories, that's what they exemplify. They exemplify the highest consciousness. And they also communicate that. And Rupa Goswami wrote the Bhakti Rasam. The author wrote it to actually explain that, to actually explain it systematically, what is devotion and how to actually come to that point. But Shastra, what Shastra is, this is Shastra, sacred text. It's meant to change you. And I always explain, it's a very interesting point, which I got from one of the great residents of the Bhakti Center named Pradyumna, who is Prabhupada's Sanskrit editor. And I was going to a class he had on the Yoga Sutras, and he explained, the mind has thoughts, and it has good thoughts, and it has bad thoughts. Klishtavritti, bad thoughts. Aklishtavritti, good thoughts. And what's good thoughts? Good thoughts are when you're attracted to things that are actually healthy and elevating to your consciousness, like discipline or compassion. And you're averse. Another good thought is you're averse to things that are not, like gluttony and frivolous talk and fault finding. And what are bad thoughts? Bad thoughts are when you're attracted to those things. You're attracted to bad things, fault finding, and lust and anger and greed. And you're averse to the good things, to devotion and discipline and compassion and so many things. So you have to, how do you change your mind? You will not change your mind unless you are inspired to do so by hearing what we would call a good idea, by hearing the truth presented in a way that inspires you, that it's actually worth your life or worth your day to actually follow it. And that's how you change. You hear regularly, and if you hear something that actually inspires you and you actually think about it and it becomes part of your thought process, there's a difference between an idea and a thought. A thought is when it becomes part of you. An idea is just an intellectual thing. But when you hear the good idea, and you hear, and if you, all of you here that are at one level of bhakti or not, it's practically by this process. You've actually heard something that made sense to you, spoke to you according to you, the frame of reference by the way you understand things, and understood, yes, it's true. I should become less selfish. Yes, it's true. I should become more disciplined. We accept these things, but unless we actually hear them and they're conceptualized in a proper way that actually inspire us, that they'll really lead us to some good, we don't generally adopt them. So this type of activity which we're doing, which is to actually, is really one of the main transformatory things that one could actually do. And even if we do this every week, and actually, you asked me, Kastuba, when's the last time that I taught this? It may have been, it was 20 years ago, and I somehow or other was out of India for a period of 6 months, and we didn't have the Bhakti Center, we had 26 Second Avenue, and I was living in New Jersey, and I started a Nectar of Devotion seminar once a week at 26 Second Avenue. And most of the people who are my students actually came from that. And I did it for the same reason. Raghunath was doing his thing and people were kind of becoming interested. And I was looking around, okay, they're interested, but they have to become more than interested. They actually have to, transform themselves and become inspired for the process. How do you do it? And we started that class. And that's the way things work. So we're going to do this. And, of course, it's a book by Rupa Goswami, fascinating personality. He was one of the greatest poets of all time. Welcome. Good. Yeah, is there a seat there? Yes. Okay, thank you. He's one of the greatest poets of all time. One day we'll show a presentation of his poetry that absolutely will blow your mind. There was actually exercises that he did where you almost basically take New York Times crossword puzzles, but without the little black squares in it. And he would write poems in Sanskrit about Krishna that would read the same way forwards and backwards. And then you think, well, that's great. Then you understand that it read the same way diagonally and across. And so many things like that. But actually had a very interesting story. He came from, I'll embarrass Megan now in many ways. He came from a Gaur Saraswat Brahmin family, which happens to be the family of her husband, from the same place in Karnataka. Very high Brahmin families. And then somehow their ancestry moved to Bengal. And at that time, the Muslims had taken over India. And him and his brother were like just so incredibly bright that the Muslim king employed them in their service as the chief minister and the home minister. It's practically the person who runs the country and runs the everything. And because of that, in the Brahmin caste, they were rejected from the Brahmin society. They even adopted Muslim names, Dabir Khas and Sakara Malik. And they basically did it as almost like a sacrifice to protect the Hindus from the Muslims because they were dependent on them. And then what happened is somehow or other they met, it's a long, long story, but they met Lord Chaitanya and they became completely inspired. In fact, Lord Chaitanya, after he took sannyas, that means he renounced family life and he was headed to Vrindavan, he just had this inspiration. He stopped at their village called Ramakeli. And somehow or other, they had written him a letter. And from that letter, he could see their heart and understood these people were worth it to actually just go to this village. And then the younger brother, which was Dabir Khas, he immediately renounced the world and went to Vrindavan. And then the king became so worried, he threw his elder brother in jail, and he eventually also was able. They were millionaires. Because they were running the kingdom. And somehow they became Lord Chaitanya's followers. And he kind of marked them as very, very special people. Even though they were so humble. Then when they came to Lord Chaitanya, there's some reason why this is done. I don't remember. They had a straw between their teeth. And they came before Lord Chaitanya. And and then they became his followers, and he instructed them. And Lord Chaitanya himself only wrote 8 verses called the Shikshastakam, which Gauravani sings. But he instructed them in actually a place now called Alabada, Prayag. He instructed them for so many days, and then, as Kasturba said, he put this knowledge into this book. And he was such an incredible, he was so humble too. And he was such an incredible personality. And he was actually given by Lord Chaitanya the legacy to actually carry out his teachings. And the things that he discovered were just like an amazing, I was explaining this. It's important for this class, and it's just a little technical, but you'll understand. That 1,500 years ago, there was this Bharat Muni. He was a great scholar. And he wrote this thing called the Natya Shastra. It's the sacred text of drama. And basically, the story is that he actually channeled this. And what happened is that the king of the universe, he's called Indra, but above him is Brahma. He's like the chief something above him. But Indra was concerned that people were not overcoming false ego. Because every single sacred text, the goal of the sacred text is you should get out of this consciousness, this false identity that I am the center of the world and happiness means to control it according to my desires. Because in that platform, real happiness, which is love, doesn't come. So somehow or other, any spiritual teaching is meant to influence you in a way to actually come to this point that, yes, this actually does not lead to happiness, and I have to come to the point of humility and service. And what Indra saw is he said, this wasn't happening. People were not getting the philosophy. He came to Lord Brahma, what to do? He said, I need something that's audible and visible. And he came up with this Natya Shastra. And what the Natya Shastra did, and it's related to this nectar of devotion, what the Natya Shastra did is it studied human experience in such a profound way. And what it studied is this term called rasa. And what rasa means is an ecstatic experience. But not just an ecstatic experience, it means an overwhelming experience. For example, anybody here? Tragedy. You're consumed with it. There's nothing else in your mind but the loss that you felt. Or there's chivalry, or I was explaining this, or there's romance. You know, when you fall in love, there's like nothing else you can see. So what this Natya Shastra did, and it's very, very technical, but it studied human experience, all these experiences, say tragedy. Who are the people who have this experience? What are the actions of these people? What is the core feeling that they have? What are the ecstatic, overwhelming bodily emotions they have, and what are all the feelings that come with this? And it's very, and they studied in a way that someone who knew this science could write a drama, and a qualified audience would experience that feeling. They would really feel tragedy. They would really feel romantic feelings. They would really feel, and there were different emotions. And then there were all kinds of theories of how this was spiritual. And one of the theories was is that when you communicate something in poetics or drama, then what happens to the audience is they have this emotional feeling that they share with others. The Greeks call it catharsis. The whole audience would feel this romance or tragedy or horror or whatever it is, but it wouldn't be connected to their ego. And there's some, they'd have an experience, but it wouldn't be connected to their limited self. And it somehow would be transcendental. Different theories were there. But what Rupa Goswami did, the author of the Nectar of Devotion, is what he did is he started to read the stories of Krishna. And he discovered this amazing thing. And the stories of Krishna were perfectly composed according to complex aesthetic theory. But they were written before the Natya Shastra. And their subject matter wasn't, even if it's elevating any mundane experience, the subject matter was bhakti rasa. It was the experience of love of Godhead. Overwhelming feelings of love of Godhead. So what he concluded is that therefore that somehow this Natya Shastra wasn't, originating these feelings, but actually it's the ultimate reality is rasa. And it's there in the Upanishads. Rasa Vaisaha. The ultimate reality is this overwhelming experience of love of God when you become perfect. And it's perfectly expressed in Krishna's Leela or Krishna's pastimes. So he actually discovered that and then wrote a book which is the Nectar of Devotion, that systematically describes it. And because he's, I'm going to tell you what the structure of the book is now, because I think it's just kind of interesting. So because he's a poet, I have it on the iPad, not the book, but because he's a poet, because he's a poet, what he does with the book is, he's like really individual. He doesn't write it in chapters. He writes it, it's an ocean, it's Sindhu. Right, it's bhakti, rasa, mrita, sindhu. Bhakti, devotional service, rasa, the overwhelming emotion of devotional service. Amrita, it's eternal, sindhu, it's an ocean. So the book is covered in sides of the ocean rather than just chapters. It has sides of the ocean. So the first side is, let me see how we do this here. What are the directions? This is east, right? So the eastern side of the ocean is just describing a varieties of devotional service. And mostly we're going to cover the eastern division. Varieties of devotional service. And it's further divided into waves. So the first wave is describing a general description of devotional service, which gives a definition in the characteristics of it. What is devotional service and what are the characteristics? And then the second wave describes it. Okay. By the way, that's called rasa bas, but I'll explain that later. And the first division is the eastern varieties of devotional service. The first wave is a general description of devotional service. Then the second wave is sadhana bhakti, devotional service and practice. And that will describe all the ways in which you can practice devotional service and who is eligible for devotional service. And then the third wave is bhava bhakti, when you actually achieve the beginning of perfection. And then the fourth wave is prema bhakti, the ultimate goal, the highest devotional feelings. All this is in this book. It's even outlined with diagrams. Okay, and then I'll just go briefly in this structure, and then we'll get to the topic of today. Okay, that's the eastern. I'm going to do it this way. Okay, that's the eastern division. Then the southern division. And what we're going to do is the southern division describes the components of this rasa. I'll just go briefly. There are different bhavas, there are different emotions. What are the components that bring love to the highest? And there are five waves, and it's described. Then the that's the southern division. Then the western division has five waves, and it describes all the relationships you can have with Krishna and how they're composed of these different emotions. And then the northern wave describes some other different subjects, indirect rasas, etc. So basically, we're going to cover the eastern division, and I'll explain. It'll be very interesting what's called the rasa theory. And we'll go into the Bhagavatam, and we'll show you how it's so composed that all the stories of Krishna, that all five emotions are just churning together to bring love to the highest. So that's just a general structure. Now, today I'm hoping we'll be able to go over the preface of the book. And what Prabhupada does is he describes the title, and really what it means. So bhakti means devotional service. And what bhakti is a very interesting thing. It's a desire in the heart that is acted upon. And that desire in the heart is bhakti, the desire to actually please God, and then it's acted upon. And that's what bhakti is. It's a devotion. And in the So I'm just going to go over the preface and how Prabhupada describes. So bhakti is the most, Prabhupada describes, he says, the basic principle of the living condition is that we have a general propensity to love someone. No one can live without loving someone else. The propensity is present in every living being. Even an animal like a tiger has a loving propensity, at the least in a dormant stage, and is certainly present in the human condition. So it's the most fundamental thing, is this desire to serve. There's a term in Sanskrit called dharma, and dharma means duty, but it really means essence. It's the quality which cannot be taken away from you, your real essence. And Prabhupada describes very simply, it's to serve or to love. You can't take that away from someone. He gave the example, we see, right? An old lady loses everyone, doesn't have a husband, has no children. They get a dog. You have to have that. You can't. That you take away liquidity, it's not water. You take away sweetness, it's not sugar. Consciousness reaches fruition in service. Consciousness is service. It may be perverted in a way, but it's that desire. So that's the most fundamental condition. So this book is bhakti. It's about the most fundamental condition. And then Prabhupada goes on, but there's a missing point. Right? And the missing point is how to fulfill it. And he says it won't be fulfilled until we repose our love so that everyone can be happy. He said in the primary stage, a child loves his parents, then his brothers and sisters. And as he daily grows up, he begins so-called love for his family, society, community, country, nation, or even the whole human society. But the loving propensity is not satisfied even by loving all human society. That loving propensity remains imperfectly fulfilled until we know who is the supreme beloved. Our love can be fully satisfied only when it is reposed in Krishna. So it's like an energy. And it only becomes satisfied, there's Twasmin Parama Prema Rup. In Narada Bhakti Sutras it says, Parama Prema Rup means the Parama Prema, the form of the topmost love is to God. And not only that, but Prabhupada explains that, and he said, and this is the theme, is the sum and substance of nectar of devotion. How to develop this love. And the nectar teaches the science of loving every one of the living entities perfectly by the easy method of loving Krishna. So it's this nectar devotion will teach us how to turn on the one switch that will immediately brighten everything, everywhere. It's like an energy and it has to expand to its greatest degree to be satisfied. When you love God, it means loving everything. It's inclusive of everything. So this is what the nectar of devotion. So that's bhakti. And what is rasa? And rasa means the taste which drives something. Why do you do something? It's the feeling of pleasure you get from it. It's this, every one of us within this world is perpetually engaged in some sort of service. And the impetus for such service is the pleasure we derive from it. Driven by affection for his wife and children, a family works day and night. A philanthropist works in the same way for love of the greater family, and a nationalist for the cause of the country and countrymen. That force which drives the philanthropist, the householder, and the nationalist called rasa. It's the taste of some kind of love or relationship. That's what rasa is. So this is bhakti. This is the taste or flavor of the relationship with the divine. That's what bhakti is, bhakti rasa. And in the preface, it'll be described that it's really hard to understand. It's like almost in one sense, it's like a young girl, if she's like 5 years old, she can't understand sex desire because she doesn't have the capacity or experience. What Prabhupada does, he'll explain it by explaining it in terms of mundane rasa, which can be exalted. It's nice. We love different people in ways. But he says mundane relationship, mundane rasa, it's chapala sukha. And what does it mean? It's flickering. Because any relationship just based on the body is temporary. So it ultimately can't fulfill you. It can satisfy you. And I want to make this point very clear that in bhakti, it's not renunciation. We don't live to enjoy. We enjoy to live. So there are desires that we have to fulfill, but it can't be the ultimate goal of life. The ultimate goal of life is something very much deeper. So he describes it's chapala sukha. This word chapala sukha means, oh, is this going on at all? Or how do we do this? This is, oh, I thought there were, okay. Anyway, we'll forget that for today. Okay. I thought the notes would be posted, but he didn't give you anything?
I mean, I got the notes, but I didn't know what he wanted to do.
What?
I didn't know what he wanted to do.
Okay. Anyway, we'll leave him for today. It won't be important. Chapala sukha means flickering happiness. So I had this fear that, I had this, not fear, I had this conception and idea is that if you achieve something temporary, then it can't be pleasure because there's fear in it of losing it. And the more you like it, the more you have that fear. And then it's bhoga tyaga. Bhoga tyaga means material pleasure, you enjoy it, and then you renounce it. And when you enjoy it, then mundane rasa, mundane pleasure, when you try to enjoy it, then it's not satisfying because it's really, it's not that love of the heart, that devotion in the heart. So it's you're not really enjoying it. But then you become frustrated and then people renounce it. But bhakti is not renunciation or indulgence. It's dedication. So we constantly go from one to another, and neither is satisfying. So he wants to contrast this, that there's actually a feeling and a relationship that's ultimately satisfying. And that's called, and that's the ultimate reality. That if you could actually enter into that, and he says that it's amrita. It's eternal. So the name of the book is Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu. See if you can find that and just put that up. It's bhakti. The Nectar of Devotion is just a Prabhupada's English translation for the original text. Bhakti Rasa, this feeling of love for Krishna. Bhakti Rasamrita. And it's eternal. It's the eternal position. And Sindhu, it's like an ocean. And that's actually the goal of life. Prabhupada said, the one switch that will immediately brighten everywhere. So that's what's discussed basically in the preface of the book. Are there any questions so far? Gail? Well, mrita means death. Amrita means not death. So there's also a beverage that's nectar. And a beverage that is nectar is supposed to be an elixir for immortality. So therefore, it's the nectar of devotion. So amrita means eternality, and it also means nectar. So Prabhupada translated it as the nectar of devotion. But the Sanskrit word means eternality. So it's something we have material consciousness means I will be happy when, and generally it's in the future, and it's the future when the world is conformed to our desires, and we derive our pleasure from that experience. The world is conformed to my desires. And generally, I'll be happy when? In the future. And generally, it never happens completely because we're not controlling the world, so it doesn't move exactly according to our desires. Everyone experiences that. And then, even when we attain it, if we do attain it, it's temporary. And even if it wasn't temporary, it's not changing the mind. It's not changing the heart. It's not our eternal nature. It's not ultimately what we are. What we are, according to the bhakti tradition, is we are receptacles of love. And we're part of the supreme love and the supreme object of love. And we're made to exchange in that. And that's called rasa. Yeah.
You said something so beautiful about bhakti. You were saying it's not renunciation.
Yeah.
And it's also not just enjoyment.
Right.
It is
dedication.
Dedication.
Yeah. Dedication. So, yeah, the perfectional state is not denying activity, and it's not indulging in activity. It's using activity in love of God. And that's the ultimate goal, to actually achieve that. And when you have that, then that's perfection. Okay, this is going faster than I thought, actually, somehow or other. I don't know why. It's always okay. Now, in the waves of devotion, I have an introduction, but the way the book is actually structured, the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the introduction is actually the beginning of the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Prabhupada writes the preface, and then he writes an introduction, but the introduction is actually the first verse of the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And any spiritual text begins with what's called the Mangalacharanam. And a Mangalacharanam means to invoke auspiciousness. Because when you're explaining spiritual things, you have to be inspired. The process of bhakti is that what you actually know comes to you by some grace. And grace is attracted by humility. So no one can actually understand anything about Krishna just by the intellect. It's just like when someone comes, people ask me, how have I come to Krishna consciousness? Right? And it's a very interesting combination. It's not exactly intellectual, and it's not completely just experiential. It's a combination of both. So if they ask me what happened, what I described is that within our hearts or within our mind, there's another sense. And it's a sense that experiences God, which is called Shraddha or faith. And it's a sublimity. And it's a drop of that rasa. It's a drop of that taste of that experience of our soul in relationship to God. And that sublimity is so great that it's beyond anything that we sensually experience by far, and it's beyond any egotistical conception we had. I'm dominant, I'm famous, I have reputation, etc. So basically, when people come to a spiritual path, whatever it is, they have a religious experience. And then that religious experience the sense of faith remains open by the reasonability of the teachings, that actually this experience is reasonable and understandable and some knowledge, etc. So that's basically what happened to me. I had an experience, but more than just an experience, you know, I came in contact with an authority on life, on spiritual life and how to live and so many things. And the combination, just keep yourself open to that experience. But you'll never achieve the path just intellectually alone. Prabhupada said it's not an intellectual process, but it's not either like the guru touches your head and there's an electric shock. But it's basically you use your intelligence in Krishna's service, and revelation or understanding comes. You're not going to, there's so many people that are so brilliant, but they don't get the simple ideas. So it's a combination of both those type of feelings. So every book begins with some kind of prayers, you know. And even myself, I don't feel that I can ever speak anything of value unless there's some inspiration. There's something that has to be given to me. And I have to be in a proper mood to receive it. So any great spiritual teacher that's going to discuss something like God, which is beyond time, which can't be confined to our own analysis, it's going to have to receive some mercy. And one's going to have to put oneself in the position to experience mercy, which is a humble heart and a humble mood. So generally, there's always prayers. It's always a Mangalacharanam, Om Agyana Timurandasya Gananjana, all these prayers. But in a book, they accomplish three things. It states the objective of the book, and it offers respects and obeisances to all the great teachers and the gurus that are going to help us. And then it offers the benedictions for the book. So what happens in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, it's very interesting. And the way Prabhupada does this, and I should tell you the way I wrote this book, you know, we started this thing called the Vrindavan Institute for Higher Education. It was the foundation of studies in ISKCON. I mean, initially we'd read, but we never had a formal school. And that at a particular time in our movement, it's historical, after Prabhupada left, you know, He said, my godbrothers criticized me because I gave all these young men the renounced order of life. And some, most of them left, you know. I remember there was this one guy, he was 21 years old. And, the, you know, Prabhupada gave him the renounced order. And he went to South India and he was going to defeat all the opposing philosophies. And he was a little bit almost like a gangster. But he was kind of intelligent too, and he had this broken nose. And they went to the head of one of these Vaishnav spiritual traditions called the Madhva Acharya. And the way they choose their people, they only have 8 sannyasis in their whole thing. They go to this village of pure Brahmins, they do astrological charts, and they pick these incredibly elevated people. And then like at 12 or something, one becomes the next acharya. You know, there's acharya, there's a junior one. It's a very, and no one has fell for 500 years. So he went and he challenged him. And he just said, it was a friend too, had a French-Canadian accent. What are the 3 aspects of the absolute truth? And the guy was so amused, he was just laughing. So Prabhupada said, when there are no trees in the forest, the castor oil tree looks big. In other words, he had, what can he do? He had no one to pass on the movement to. But I came actually yesterday on plane. Yesterday I came 7 hours. So I tried to beat jet lag. I think I'm 70% there. But so what I was explaining is, so, you know, basically Prabhupada took the young and passionate people and he just engaged them. But then at a particular time, when he left, the oldest people were like 28, 29, 30 years old. So some of them became the gurus. There was nobody else. They were just these young people. And naturally, they were monks, and then they had followers, and so many of them just couldn't maintain that level of renunciation. And then the movement was in distress, and you know, people started just taking shelter of Vrindavan, where before, no one used to go there. They'd only go there once a year. We'd see people once a year during the Gaur Purnima festival, no other time. And all of a sudden, everybody was coming. And my friend and I assisted. We started this educational institution. And then we started teaching the books. So what I did is I wanted to teach this nectar of devotion that Prabhupada had very, very thoroughly. So what I did is I had one teacher, and he knew the Indian languages, and I sat with the original text. And then I saw what Prabhupada did. Prabhupada read a verse and then wrote a paragraph, and then read a verse and wrote a paragraph. So what I did is I took the original verse and the commentary and saw what else I could add to make this even more clear. And I wrote this book, Waves of Devotion. So basically what I saw is the first 6 verses of the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the original text, were the first 6 paragraphs of the Nectar of Devotion, except Prabhupada made it personal towards himself. So the first verse is a famous verse. It states the objective. And it states the objective, and the objective is Krishna. And there's a famous verse about Krishna. And it has a famous description of Krishna, which says, Akila Rasam Rita Murti. So who is Krishna? This is the objective. Akila means complete. Rasam Rita means the Murti, the complete form. What is the conception of Krishna? And this book is about Krishna. Akila Rasam Rita Murti, the complete embodiment of all love. Rasa means relationships. And when you think about that, that actually is the highest manifestation of being. The highest manifestation of being is their love, is being a friend, is being a lover, and being a parent, being a servant. They once asked this great Christian apologist, famous person, Alvin Plantinga, they said, is God a person? He said, he's not less than a person. And what is a person? It's his love. The fullest manifestation of a person is his heart. When you meet someone and you don't know them, they're a stranger. And what happens when you have a relationship with the person? Then you get to know them. What do you know? You know their heart. So what the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu said, it's non-sectarian. There's one absolute truth. There's a supreme being, which is Advayam Gyan, which is consciousness, which is inclusive of everything. But he doesn't have the defect of impersonality. I wrote a drama that about, you know, God, Krishna, a reasonable conception of divinity. It was part of the drama. And I said, everyone here is looking for pleasure. Pleasure is love. If that's the guiding principle here, why shouldn't that be manifest in the ultimate reality? At least according to this tradition, it makes sense to me. And therefore, the one harmonious whole must have energies and distinctions for the exchange of love. And that's what the objective of life is, to actually get free of ego and be qualified to actually participate in that and experience that. And that's reasonable. If there is a God, if there is an absolute reality, then the absolute reality is enjoying. And what is he enjoying? He's enjoying love. That's our experience here. And this perfect love, this selfless love. So Krishna means Akila, complete, Murti, he's the form of the complete what? Akila Rasamrita. Rasamrita, the nectar. The nectar of rasa, of love. I always tell this story so many times, Gail must have heard it 1,000 times, that Prabhupada gave a very heavy lecture on yam and niyam. A very, very heavy lecture. Yam, and he said, no gambling, no meat eating, no intoxication, no illicit sex. Very, very heavy lecture. And then someone raised his hand. What do you do in your society for recreation? And Prabhupada said, our society is simply recreation. He said, chanting, dancing, and feasting. He said, you never see a picture of Krishna in the spiritual world smoking a cigarette and wearing and wearing a construction helmet. And Prabhupada had one godbrother, of the same guru, Bhakti Siddhanta, who was a German. Because before Prabhupada went to the West, this one other person went to the West, and he came back with these two Germans. And he got, and this German guy was brilliant, and he looked like Prabhupada's guru. And Prabhupada always used to say how intelligent he was. He actually went to India to look for God, and he saw so many different forms of God. And when he saw Krishna, and he saw him playing his flute, he said, this must be God, because God must be enjoying. And enjoying what? Enjoying love. And that's not limiting. It's actually limiting to deny that in God. God is everywhere. Everything is included. is the energy of God, but he doesn't have the defect of impersonality. He can love fully. And that's what he does. And that's what the Bhagavatam describes this feeling, this bhakti ras, this eternal energy of love and devotion that completely overwhelms one eternally in lila or pastimes with God. And that's what this book is about. It's how to practice it and how to get it. So the objective of the book is developing love for God. And what's going to be described later on when they give a definition of pure devotional service, what's described later on is that Krishna also is not a limiting concept. It's not everything. It includes his expansions in different forms of God and his differentiating parts and parcels and his living entities. That's also bhakti. But Krishna means Akhila Rasamrita Murti, the full embodiment of love. So that's the first verse of the Nectar of Devotion and the first verse of the... And it says, Akhila Rasamrita Murti is the whole verse, and it says, Vidyu Jayate. Vidyu means defeat or produces. Jayate means excels everything. And what excels everything? It's love. And if God is not the full embodiment of love, he's not God. And that's Krishna. And Krishna means all attractive. Then the second verse is Rupa Goswami, he offers his respects to Lord Chaitanya. This is also the second paragraph, who taught him the science. You offer your respects to those who taught you this science. And that actually connects you to their blessings and potency. But the second paragraph, you see, Prabhupada didn't learn directly from Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So Prabhupada offers respects to his own guru. So Prabhupada takes he's offering his respects to who he learned the subject from. I'm thinking in the future, I'm trying to get an idea. Prabhupada says, let me offer respectful obeisances unto the lotus feet of Rupa Goswami and Bhakti Siddhanta, whose inspiration I've been engaged in the matter of compiling the summary study of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Do you understand? Rupa Goswami's verse was, I became inspired by Lord Chaitanya. So Prabhupada, he says, let me offer respects to whom I got inspired. And because Prabhupada wants to be chaste to the original text, he also said, this is the sublime science of devotional service as propounded by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Then the third verse is Rupa Goswami glorifies his guru. And who is his guru? His older brother, who is named Sanatan Goswami, who was an amazing personality. He used to travel from... What happened is when this home minister and chief minister, when Lord Chaitanya inspired them, and they just left everything. And they just chakt vaturna mashesha mandala patishrine. They renounced everything as insignificant. Why? Bhutva dina ganesha kau karunaya. Out of compassion for who? Bhutva dina, for all the dina, all the poor people in the world. And what's the greatest poverty? What is the greatest poverty?
Lack of love.
Lack of love from someone who's full of it. Not full of love, full of love, full of love, full of love, I meant. But, so it's Bhutva Dina out of compassion, Kopina Kantra. All they had was some loincloth and their neck beads. And they were the chief ministers, they were billionaires. So his guru was his older brother, and he was very, they were very, very humble. And he used to walk from village to village in Vrindavan, because they were trying to, Lord Chaitanya gave them many missions, but once to go to Vrindavan and rediscover all the places of Krishna's pastimes. So he used to go to each village, and they used to chant, they used to meditate, and they used to feel the places, just like we were in Radhakund, we felt the place. And you go to different places, they felt the internal place. So that was his guru. And actually, when he would leave the villages, the whole village would follow him. Because it said, there's really a verse about him, Dira, Dira, Janapriyo, Priyakaro, Namatsaro. They were loved. Dira, Dira, they were loved by the gentle and the ruffians, Nimatsarao Pujatao, because they weren't envious of anyone. So even rough people, they saw there's no competition there. So they all would follow him out of the village. So that was his guru. So the third, in the nectar devotion, he offers his respects. And Prabhupada just does this in the third person, because he already offered respects to his guru. So Prabhupada said, Rupa Goswami begins the book by offering obeisances to his elder brother and spiritual master, and praise, it must be pleasing to him. And that's the only reason people do bhakti. They do it to please. That's the essence of bhakti. So he's doing it to please his brother or his guru. And he prays that his brother will be satisfied with this. So this is basically, it's God, then guru, and then the devotees. So then in the third verse, the fourth verse, he offers respects to the great holy teachers who, it's an interesting analogy, who are compared to sharks in the great ocean of nectar and who do not care for the various rivers of liberation. And the analogy, because Rupa Goswami is a poet, the rivers flow into the ocean. The ultimate shelter is the ocean. The ultimate shelter is devotion. Everything else leads there. And great devotees are like sharks. Why? Sharks live in the ocean. They live in the ultimate reality. And they, sharks reject, they don't see sharks in the rivers. They reject it as insignificant. So they reject all other paths as insignificant because this is the ultimate shelter. And also, sharks are not caught by the fishermen because they're so deep. So the devotees are so deep in that ocean. Rupa Goswami later gives a verse about bhakti. He said, if you multiply the pleasure given by liberation by the highest unlimited number, he says you cannot compare material pleasure to moksha. Even in the Yoga Sutras, it says when the yogi gets to his level of meditation, where he's able to meditate on prakriti, in other words, he gets beyond all forms of everything and he just sees substance of reality. He sees prakriti, he sees the substance of reality. Then there's such an incredible pleasure that comes from that. What to speak when you get liberated. So material pleasure, which is chapala sukha, it's temporary, it's filled with fear, it's not the ultimate goal, and it's bhoga tyaga. It's not ultimately satisfying, it's not our ultimate nature, and therefore we vacillate, we enjoy, and then we renounce. We stuff our faces, and then we go on fast, and then we stuff our faces, and then we go on fast. You know, we're not satisfied with the renunciation or that. One time I was with this devotee, Giriraj Swami. I think he'll be here the last day, and I think I'll have him speak. He's very, very special, elevated soul. He was actually the son of a very, 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 very rich lawyer. And when he joined Krishna consciousness, it was this lawyer, Jewish lawyer, rich judge, Chicago. He was so, his father came all the way to India and went to his son and said, I'll offer you $1 million if you give this up. And that time, that was a lot more money than it is today. And he said, why? You know, why do I need it? I'm just, you know, I'm satisfied in Krishna consciousness. And when Prabhupada heard that, Prabhupada quoted, Chaktva Tornam Asesha Mandala Pati Shanim. He kicked off all aristocracy as insignificant. So maybe the last day he's going to be visiting me upstate, and maybe I'll bring him here. Maybe he can speak for an hour. But I was once with him, and he told me this. He was telling me these things because he was very, very close with Prabhupada. Very close with Prabhupada. And he told me that Prabhupada said, a third-class man eats very, very little. A third-class man eats a lot, right, and can't control his tongue. A second-class man eats very, very little. And a first-class man eats Krishna prasadam and does a lot of service. So you multiply material pleasure by a millionfold. Rupa Goswami says it doesn't equal a drop of the ocean of the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. God's, what is bhakti? It's the essence of God's bliss potency. And it's put in our hearts. See, God has two pleasures. Sarupananda, he's happy in himself. Like swinging on a hammock. You just, by yourself, you swing on the hammock. That's one type of pleasure. And then the other type of pleasure is love. And the pleasure of love is something that has to come from outside you to you. So the concept of Krishna consciousness, God is Sarupananda, he's pleasurable, but he's also expanded for that exchange of love. And what is our, who are we ultimately? We're receptacles of that love. We're meant to be receptacles of love when we purify our hearts and we actually want it. We become receptacles of that love. And that's the path of bhakti. You purify your heart, you advance more and more and more and more and more and more until the voice in your heart is, I want to please Govinda. I want to please Krishna. I want. That becomes your desire. Not, I want this, I want that, I don't want this from the false ego, all those things. But there's a voice in your heart. You're meditating and you find that voice in your heart that is love. And love for God, which is inclusive of everything. And that voice increases and increases and increases. And at a particular time, it's calling out so loudly that Krishna may give you that shakti. We want to serve, and he gives you that energy in your heart. And it's the essence of bliss potency. And the nature of love, the receptacle of the receiver of the love enjoys it, but the receptacle of that love, the abode of that love, and there's the object of that love, they enjoy equally. So the concept of bhakti is that. And when you get that and you're swimming in it, he says, like the great devotees, they're so deep in that, there's no fear. There's nothing else that can take them away from that. And then the fifth verse, which is the fifth paragraph, he describes, he prays to his spiritual master for protection, that he should not be disturbed by all the other argumentative logicians and all the people that are presenting so many confusing theories against the principle of devotion. And he said, and because he's a poet, he said, he compares this to the arguments that come against this bhakti principle, like there's volcanoes in the ocean. They're exploding, but they don't affect the ocean. So in the same way, let all these big people, and you know, in India too, there are people of so many different paths, and they would debate. And if you lost the argument, you'd have to become their disciple. So it was a very frightening thing. Like we have heavyweight champions, like physical heavyweight champions. They would have like these great, powerful logicians. So it was actually a fact, Lord Chaitanya, he was only 16 and he was a great logician. And he was Shrutidhara. And Shrutidhara means, and they even have this in India, there are people who can hear something once and retain it. Shruti means hearing and Dhara means to hold. It's the opposite of in one ear and out the other. It's Shrutidhara. You can hold that once. So what happened once is this great scholar, and he was the head of another sampradaya, came to Navadvipa where Lord Chaitanya lived, also was a town of scholars and this logic, but they were afraid to debate this guy, so they sent Lord Chaitanya. It's true. And he was only 16. Because they felt if he loses, then okay, he's only 16. But if he wins, so Lord Chaitanya challenged him first and said, compose 100 verses on the Ganga. And the guy just went, this was the original rap, but this was in this was in Sanskrit, and it just went boom, 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 boom. 100 verses, and Lord Chaitanya memorized them all and then found a minor discrepancy. And the minor discrepancy is when he needed to have a rhyme for Lord Shiva, he needed alliteration, he gave the term Bhavani Bhartu, which means in Sanskrit, the husband of the wife of Lord Shiva. So who's the husband of the wife of Lord Shiva?
Shiva.
Lord Shiva. But it's ambiguous. It has the slight discrepancy of ambiguity, because the way it's stated, it seems that the wife of Lord Shiva has another husband. Because it says the wife of the husband of Lord Shiva. So Lord Chaitanya memorized it and pointed that out. So there were so many powerful. So he's prayed. And because he's also, he's very, very humble. So he prayed. In fact, in the second verse, he described himself as Varaka Rupa. And it's so beautiful. Varaka Rupa. Rupa means, you know, the person, Rupa Goswami, but Rupa also means form, and Varaka means insignificant. So he said, he addressed himself as the form of insignificance. And then the sixth verse, he offers a benediction. And whoever reads this book, he blesses, will get transcendental happiness. And then he also says, I'm ignorant, and I've done this for the pleasure of my guru. And then Prabhupada describes that this has to be the mood of anyone who wants to share Krishna consciousness. That we're unfit for the work, but we do it as a service. And Prabhupada said, this should be the attitude of all people in the Krishna consciousness movement. We never think we're great preachers, but we're simply instruments. Our greatness is that we're instruments. And what's an instrument? It has no value if it's not guided or used by something else. So you may be the most beautiful knife or the most beautiful this or the beautiful that, but actually we're instruments. And anyone who has experience in Krishna consciousness knows that that's how it actually works. You become instruments. And he blesses who ever reads this book will get some benefit. So basically, that's just how he his heart, and he introduced the book, and Prabhupada summarizes it in that way. So we're actually going to get to more than I actually thought we would, but I'm getting a sense of it because this is the first class, and it's always hard when you I'm doing this in not like every day, like I would do, you know, verse by verse, etc. But okay, I'm getting a sense of how to do this through the nectar of devotion. So then he describes the structure. There's a paragraph there. You can I'll get a book next time, and you can even follow along in the book. That will be easily. So he divided into four parts, the ocean. And the first part is a general description of devotional service. And that's what we're going to discuss, a general description. And the first thing he does is give a definition. And this is what Rupa Goswami did. He defined everything from what is bhava, what is prem, what is sadhana. So what is a good definition? A good definition is not too exclusive and not too inclusive. Like, let's see. Let's say you have a chair. So you say, define this, right? Well, it's a seat. Is that a good definition? No, because also a couch is a seat, an asana is a seat. So it's not a good definition because it's too broad. Or if it's too narrow, it's a seat for a businessman. No, it's not only businessmen sit on chairs, you know? So that's too narrow. So he's going to give a definition. And this is the essence, this is the most important verse. Yeah, up there. This is the most important verse in the whole book. And the definition, you'll see how perfect it is. So, definition is, there's what's called a sarup lakshanam and a tatastha lakshanam. A sarup lakshanam means that it's the core understanding of it, and then the tatastha lakshanam, which will come second, modifies it so that it's completely precise. So this is the basic definition of devotional service, what it means. Let me make sure everybody sees. The basic definition of devotional service, of what it means, and this modifies it to make it pure devotional service. So, but this is the basic definition of what devotional service means. And so it's for Krishna. That's the basic thing of devotional service. Now, that seems very, very exclusive, doesn't it? That bhakti is just for Krishna? How many people think that's too exclusive? It's too exclusive. Right? I can't serve Kastuba? Can that be bhakti? What about Ram? Can that be bhakti?
Well, if you have the highest understanding that Kastuba.
What? What's that?
Serving him to divine understanding, you're serving Krishna.
Say Say that again? Yeah, go ahead.
In serving Kastubha with the right understanding,
yeah.
You serve him with the understanding that he's Krishna, that Krishna dwells within him.
Not with the understanding that he's Krishna, but the understanding that he's connected to Krishna. So what it says is Krishna means his personal expansions. Krishna has so many expansions. His differentiated parts, living entities, is also bhakti. Krishna's paraphernalia, his abode. What about Saibel when you're sweeping Vrindavan? Is that bhakti? Bhakti. So things connected to Krishna. So the definition, first thing, it's for Krishna. He's the single target of pure devotion. As a result of this one-pointed love for Krishna, one loves everything directly connected to him. And that's bhakti. So the main thing, it's for Krishna. And it's then the second thing is Krishna Shilanam. This is Bhaktir Uttama. This is pure top bhakti. So what is pure top bhakti? Krishnanu Shilanam. It's Shilanam. Shilanam means what? It means activity. It's not just bhakti is consciousness. It's not just some feeling in the heart. It's a feeling in the heart that's expressed. It's not that bhakti means you're just sitting there. That also can be bhakti if you're meditating on Krishna. And shilina means activities without the mind, the body, and the words. There's also, we shouldn't forget, there's a mental culture of Krishna consciousness. You can think. Prabhupada said the mental. He even said that when you eat, you can think. Mental cult, you can think of Krishna with the cowherd boys eating. There's a mental mind, body, and words. So, and Anu. Anu means that which follows. Isn't that Ter Kadamba? What does the word Anu mean?
Following.
So it's activities that follow Krishna. Right? And what is following Krishna means? It means following Krishna's desire. It means connecting, following. What does bhakti mean? You connect with the desire of Krishna. This is really doesn't stay well. You're connecting with the desire of Krishna. But it's still not precise. Because you can connect with the desire of Krishna and it's not bhakti. And they said Krishna kills demons. And he fights, right? There are people that are inimical to him. So it's described in the Krishna Leela. Somehow he's fighting with demons. And it's concentrated on Krishna, but it's not bhakti. Why? Because anukulyena, it's not favorable. It's not intended. So the Sarup Lakshanam is activities that are intended to please Krishna. That's the core thing of bhakti. When your activities are following Krishna's desire, but are intended. And this anukulyena, it's so important that it's described also that sometimes Mother Yasoda, she punishes her son out of love. And that's bhakti, because she's intending to please him. She's intending to serve him. So anukulyena means favorable, and it can't be separated from Shilinim. Shilinim alone, activities alone, you can't, and it gives an example in the book, it's just intended to please Krishna, not just incidentally pleasing Krishna. Without shilanam is not enough. It must be anukulena, Krishna anu shilanam. That's bhakti. That's the core definition of bhakti. And this anu, Prabhupada describes this. How do you follow Krishna? How do you follow Krishna? This means you have to be connected to Krishna's desire. And that's actually what spiritual life means. You have to be connected to some will higher than your own I want whims. You have to be surrendered. Surrender to what? You surrender to truth. Right? There's a truth that's higher than your own whims. Right? It's higher than your own whims. And you have to be connected to that truth for it to be bhakti. It's just higher than your own whims. So how do you get connected to that will? We want that will in every circumstance right now. Right? If we want bhakti, you want to know what pleases, so you have to know what the desire is. So it's described, Prabhupada describes this anu in several ways. One is connection with Krishna and that telegraphic connection, what the desire is the disciplic succession. It's connected to Krishna through people, through gurus, through teachers who connect you with that will and that desire. And Prabhupada talks about that extensively also. Because without that, how can we know what actually pleases Krishna? And I had a realization about this. I don't know if how well this will go, but how if it'll be understood. See, when I give this class, I'm coming on a, I think it's a 7 hour or 8 hour time difference. I can't be jet lagged. So I have to make a strategy not to be jet lagged. So I drink a lot of hot water on the plane. I don't eat much. I walk around the plane. I don't go to sleep the day I arrive. And as soon as I arrive, I go to 131 Essex Street and go to Bud. And as soon as I get off the plane, before I take a shower, before I go here, I go to Veera Bhadraram and I get this Marma massage. And I just, you know, he was pulling my legs different ways. And he was just saying kind of like, let go, let go. And I was just letting go. Yeah, I was just letting go. And he was just, you know, and I just realized that that's really bhakti. I really realized that that's bhakti. You're letting go, but, you know, for like, because he knows better and he loves me. And he loves the people he treats. So that feeling of kind of letting go to like a higher power, and it was just so relaxing. You know, I just, no, that's, and then, you know, and he pulled my hand, no, just relax, and down and up. And I, yeah, okay, I'm just like, and I just had this realization that we have this, you know, we have this conditioning against surrender because we kind of feel like it's something forced. But no, it's kind of surrendering to a will that's higher than our whims. We can look at it, truth is a will that's higher than our whims. And when we're moved by the truth, and when you're part of something, the part which you're something, part which you are something of is a higher truth than your independent desires. It's just like when you have the body, Prabhupada gave the example. The will of the body is higher than the will of the hand. And the will, the hand, because it's part of the body, it serves the will of the body and it feeds the body, and then the hand actually has meaning, and then it also has replenishment. So that's really what bhakti is. You're connecting with this higher will to serve this higher will, which is serving everything. The hand serves the body, it serves everything. When we're serving God, and what's the service for God? The service of God is to please Him. And what's pleasing? It is that bhakti. We are meant to be receptacles for that and exchange in that. And it's a very beautiful conception of the ultimate reality. You may have different conceptions. I'm just presenting what Rupa Goswami says. And because it's my own tradition, I think I have some feeling and some realization for it. It's just a beautiful thing. It's just like when we have retreats and the retreat is organized, the community is organized to serve all the individuals, right? And you just kind of let go of that independent desire that it's me, I have to move things around the world for my pleasure. And then all of a sudden, no, what's happening in the retreat? And then what happens? You want to serve it. Let me do the service. Let me not fill my own desire, but let me serve out. Let me do. You have any service? Because we all know inherently that that's more pleasing and natural to the self. But how to find what that is? And it's anu. It means connecting with the desire of Krishna, and that desire flows through the disciplic succession. I just met this one person. Anyway, in India, I met her here at the Bhakti Center, and she's very well connected in the country she comes from, and she's very powerful and very talented, and she has two fields of study. She's knows child psychology and modern education, all the progressive education, and she also knows art. And she wants to do so, you know. So she's asking me, you know, well, how can I, you know, connect this with Krishna? Right? How can I connect it with Krishna? Or how can I use it in Krishna's service? So I explained to her, you know, probably, you know, don't do it to try to convert young children. That's, you know. You know, if you want to do it, you know, maybe if you want to help the mission in your country, you may meet influential people, you know. Or you may, if you really want to do that, then start a school. But you don't want to start a school. Then you can, you know, give kids some good values and things like that. But I said, ultimately, you know, you have to connect it to Krishna. And that means through a disciplic succession that says, yes, this is Krishna's desire. You know, this is Krishna's desire. And then you're like, then that's bhakti. Because it's not, you know, it's not mixed with the false ego that gets in there, that I'm doing this, but actually I'm surrendered to Krishna and His desire. And I'm going to move, and therefore I'm going to move with love in the rest of my life. So Krishnanu, we'll just go over that one more time. And Anushilanam, it can be positive or negative. It can be positive. It's the activities you do to please Krishna or the things that you avoid to please Krishna. So there are things like don't commit offenses. Don't, you know, do, you know, it's the yams and niyams, the rules and the regulations. The positive, the yams, you know, what you do. Bhakti uttama. Okay, but still, this is not yet, this is the sarup. The sarup means the very essence. Lakshana means the symptoms, the primary symptoms. But, Bhatti, we'll just leave this up here because I'll work with the definition. But, anya bilashita shunyam jnana karma dhyanavritam. But if you really want it to be pure devotional service, shunyam means desire. Anya abhilas means without any desires, without any personal desires. But if you define that as bhakti, there's a problem. Because there are desires that you can have that don't disqualify you from pure devotional service, personal desires. For example, the example they give is, let's say that your life is being threatened, right? And you say, help, help, save me. You know, it's a desire for self-preservation, right? But therefore, he says, this is very subtle, but it's very beautiful, and you'll see how he makes that definition. Anya bilashita. What time is it now? Is that when the class is supposed to end? It's supposed to end at 5:30. Okay. Okay, I'm going to do this quickly, and I want to end with something. So it says it's not without any desires, because there's desires that are not integral to your core motives. If you say, I have to go to the bathroom, I mean, is that against pure devotional service? You're not a pure devotee, because you have a desire for yourself. You're hungry. So it says, anyabila shita. This means like ness, without zero desire ness, without selfish motives. See, it's not without any desires. Other is anya means other desires. Without any other desires than this, then you're a pure devotee? No. That's too exclusive, because you have desires that are just natural desires. They're not like your core motive, but they're natural desires that come from one. And then it says, jnana karma jnavritam, and not covered by jnana and karma, which means you can have karma and it doesn't exclude you from being a pure devotee. I'll give you an example. When Lord Chaitanya's father died, he went to Gaya and performed some ritualistic ritualistic activities for his father's death. Now, in the bhakti tradition, when someone dies, right, what this ceremony is, what you can do is, one of the things you do is you feed the Vaishnavas, the saintly people, on the deceased one's behalf. When I was in Puri, there's one person I've known here for 15 years. You saw that old car I got 15 years, 10 years ago. He gave me that old car, and he called me up. My father died. You know, his name was John Trini, a nice Italian guy. Just a little side note. He opened a new house he had. He said, look, I want a festival where everybody comes. I said, marketing. I got the greatest idea. Yeah. You call the festival, because you're Italian. You bring your mother here to help you. And you call it the mother of all Italian feast festivals. So anyway, his Italian father died. And he called me up. What should I do? So we were in Puri. And we said, well, we'll feed the Vaishnavas. And he sent a picture of his father. And we offered the prasadam to his father and all the Vaishnavas. And this saint was sitting next to me, this Dr. Fakir Mohan, one of the most learned scholars in the Vaishnava. And he's saying, yes, this is it. The father, you know, this is the way you do it. But he performed some ritual. But if he didn't perform that ritual, it was the social milieu of the day, if he didn't perform that ritual, then he would be criticized. So there's certain things that you do and certain activities you do in relationship to obligations of family and different things that may not be like directly, you know, anukulyena Krishna anu, directly, you know, Krishna's desire. But there's things you do, but they don't cover So it's only without things that are not covering. And same thing with Gyan. It doesn't mean we don't cultivate knowledge. We cultivate knowledge, we study. It means impersonal knowledge. But you're not. But we can study, we can analyze, we can, even Bhagavad Gita has so many verses of Sankhya and analysis. It's not about Krishna, but it doesn't cover our devotion. So in this way, he writes this perfect definition, and basically what is it? It's activities that are intended to please Krishna, that are connected to Krishna through the teachers and people who are in connection with Krishna, representing the disciplic succession, and that don't have any other motive and are not covered by ordinary activities and philosophical pursuits. So it's a perfect definition. And somehow we basically covered, there's a few more points I covered. I will cover next time. I needed the first class to stand up. I needed the first class to actually get a sense of how we'll proceed now. And I got it. What I'm going to do now is I'm just going to prepare the Nectar of Devotion and go through the book itself. So we'll read Prabhupada and just explain it like that. So we read the preface, which gave the title Bhakti Rasa Mrita Sindhu. Bhakti is devotional service. It's the nature of the soul, and that connection with Krishna, that love, that bhakti ras, that type of flavor of love, which is the essence of life, is the flavor of love. That type of flavor of love is ultimately satisfying. It's the goal of life, and it's eternal. I had that realization once. I was going through some kind of real tribulations, and I always described it that I wanted my world to go this way, and the world was going this way so rapidly, and that's anxiety. Anxiety is when our attachments are not fulfilled, our desires are not fulfilled, and it just wasn't moving, and it was, you know, I was just looking at the world. I want this, and it was going this way. I want this, it was going this way. And I took shelter in spiritual activities, and I just began to chant and hear and worship. You know, I was chanting so much, and I took shelter of just chanting. And what is chanting? It's bhakti. It's the expression of desire to please Krishna, and it's that ras. And the realization that I had is this activity is really connected to my true self, because what I am is consciousness, which is meant for love. And this is actually connected to my real self. And then, and all these other things that come from the false ego, the anxieties and all these other things, they're connected to a false self, which is temporary. So I had the feeling, and it was such a relief, that this activity and who is doing this activity doesn't end with the body. So bhakti rasamrita sindhu, that activity, it doesn't end with the body. It's the real eternal self awakening. And therefore it's free from any fear. And when you do those activities, and that's the goal of life. So we went on those two things. Now what I'm going to do now is first of all, please, we'll bring the rest of the Bach downstairs. We'll let them do through the Bhakti Cafe. If you don't have a Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, a Nectar of Devotion, you should buy one in the cafe for the book, and you should also get the Waves of Devotion. It's a nice summary, and for the next week, what we'll read is chapter 1 of the Nectar of Devotion. That's what we'll do. Chapter 1, which is beautiful. We're going to discuss the characteristics of pure devotional service. And we'll also kind of review this, because I really feel that the first time, just getting a sense of the class and how to do it and trying to transcend jet lag, it's not the standard of clarity that I want. Now, what I'm going to do to finish the class is kind of partner up. It doesn't matter with someone or, okay? And either two or three. And what I'd like to do at the end of the class is, and this is just for you, it's called free writing. And you don't have to look at your notes, just what you remember from the class that struck you. And then for two or three minutes, we're just going to write like that. But the key is not to let the pen drop. And you'll just keep on writing when I say, okay? And then you'll just break up, and I'll help you break up. Don't worry about it. Rin, get the pen. You have one? Okay, you have a pen? Everyone got a pen? Okay? Don't have to look at the notes. Just write what you remember, what struck you, and then just, we'll do it for 5 minutes. Okay? Just get the pen and just keep the pen moving. Okay. Anybody doesn't have one, then. Okay? Just keep on writing. Just have the pen move. Whatever you remember in the class, just keep the pen moving. Okay? And even if you don't remember something, say, I don't remember something. And it's only for you anyway. And just keep the pen right moving. Okay. Can everybody look up? Okay. Can everybody look up? Okay. Okay. Hi, Bo. Good. Good. I was quite happy that people were writing so vigorously. It means that they... Copiously, yeah. That it means that they... you know, we're retaining things and remembering things from the lecture. It's also a good first start. I think I have a sense of how this can be done in this particular group, in this particular circumstance. If you want to attend the class regularly, then you should register. And I think you can register at the front desk if you want. If that's difficult for them financially and they need some break on it or more than a break, you can just see me personally, okay? But you should register. And then if you register and we have your email, Ruti, who's going to start this group? How does that work? You're not even on Facebook, right?
I know. I'm a pariah.
Well, yeah, so... Anybody can do that? Set up a group? How does that work? What? You'll figure it out. So we'll set up a group and we'll post the video and any type of other things that anybody can ask any questions also. Okay? And I think the first thing I'll do in the next class is I'll always summarize what we discussed previously. And also... I did this book, I think, many, many years ago, so I'm kind of revising how it's actually structured. So I'll be able to give just a very short 10 or 15 minute summary. So always revising, really, what are the what are the main points that we really want to learn. And next week, we'll learn the 6 characteristics of pure devotional service, which is the first 2 manifest at the platform of practice, which is Klesh Agni, It means all distress are destroyed. And it's a very interesting discussion of what actually causes distress and how devotional service finishes. Shubhada, it creates all auspiciousness, which means it creates all good qualities, it benedicts everyone, and so many. Then at the platform of Bhava, Dulabha, it's difficult to attain. And Moksha Lugudakrit. Lugudakrit means to make very small. What is moksha, liberation, devotional service. And then at Prema Bhakti, Sandrandana Visheshatma, how the happiness is very thick and very deep. And Sri Krishna Karshani, devotional service can even attract Krishna. So we'll discuss that. And what Rupa Goswami will do, we'll go over different references and how this is. So basically, we'll get, what does the title mean? We'll go over again, what is the definition of devotional service? We'll learn the six characteristics. The next chapter is the eligibility. What is the qualification for devotional service? And then you'll get into actually the principles and practices. There's 64 practices of how you practice devotional service and which are the most potent. And then we'll go on and describe this. good. If I haven't met anybody personally or just met you briefly, if you'd like to come say hello, I'd like to know everyone that's in the class. It's my nature. I'm not taking the pills. I'm going to take them. Okay. Okay. Thank you so much for coming. Okay.